Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. President Biden visits Texas today, his first official visit to a disaster zone.
Meanwhile, in Washington, the future of the president's $15 federal minimum wage proposal is very much in doubt. It's part of his big coronavirus relief bill that comes up for a vote in the House later today. But last night, the Senate parliamentarian ruled against it. Our Friday Politics Roundtable is here. Beth Fooey, Senior Politics Editor at NBC News and MSNBC. Beth, welcome.
Thank you.
And Scott Wong, Senior Staff Writer at The Hill. Scott, welcome to you.
Hi, guys.
And Scott, start with you. Is that the final word on the $15 minimum wage?
Well, not if you talk to progressive Democrats in the House and the Senate. They are still fighting to get some version of this $15 minimum wage provision in this COVID package. I mean, they are really upset with the Senate parliamentarian for issuing this ruling last night. There's talk, you know, from progressives like AOC and Ilhan Omar of potentially removing her or trying to get the vice president, Kamala Harris, to overturn the ruling. There's also a push from leadership, specifically from the Senate finance chairman, Ron Wyden, who says he wants to impose a 5% tax penalty on large corporations like Walmart if they don't pay a $15 minimum wage. So, you know, there's still some hope that progressives believe that they can get some version of a $15 minimum wage. Nancy Pelosi in the House Democrats today will pass their own package and keep the $15 minimum wage in there. They believe this was a promise that they made to their progressive base, and they want to stick to it.
I think it's a surprise to a lot of people that the Senate parliamentarian wields so much power. Politico is reporting that the National Black Women's Roundtable and the Urban League are among the groups asking for a meeting with Vice President Harris to pressure her to overrule the parliamentarian, which she can do as the Senate president, as Scott just mentioned. Beth Fooey, where does the White House stand on this?
Well, where the White House stands is we've got a president, Joe Biden, who spent 36 years in the Senate and we know is extremely respectful of the Senate's sometimes antiquarian ways, and respecting the will of the Senate parliamentarian is very much in keeping with the Biden approach to all things in the Senate. The White House said last night that they were disappointed with the decision, that they were going to look for other ways to push forward with a $15 minimum wage, but it's unlikely that they would ever take any step quite so draconian as to fire the parliamentarian. The other thing, of course, that this is going to lift focus on is the question of the filibuster. Progressives are very much using this as an example of why the filibuster needs to be gotten rid of in the Senate. Of course, that is the rule that 60 votes need to be assembled for any major provision to move through. Joe Biden has also said he doesn't support that. He does not support removing the filibuster. So we're seeing very much in keeping with Joe Biden all along. He is respecting the traditions and the mores of the Senate, perhaps at the consternation of some of his more progressive backers.
Scott Wong, let's move on to another story. Last night, the Biden administration authorized its first military strike in Syria. This was against Iranian-backed militias that are operating or launching attacks into Iraq. Help us understand the significance of this and what it signals to you.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is, you know, President Biden from the outset has talked about diplomacy, that he wanted to sort of hit the reset button on diplomacy. But at the same time, you know, in the past 2 weeks, we've seen attacks by militia groups, Iranian-backed militia groups that killed a civilian contractor, that injured several Americans. So this was what is being seen as a retaliatory strike against some of those Iranian-backed militia groups in Syria. Most Democrats, the reaction on Capitol Hill, most Democrats are standing with President Biden. They're giving him the benefit of the doubt. However, there are some progressives like Ro Khanna of California, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who are questioning Biden's constitutional authority. Biden did not come to Congress first. He did not seek an AUMF, an authorization for the use of military force. And so progressives are looking at this a little bit critically, although I would say by and large, Democrats are giving the president the benefit of the doubt.
Beth, what do you make of the politics of this? Because, you know, Scott just talked about the Democrats. On the Republican side, we're seeing Texas Republican Michael McCaul praised Biden's actions, said they were necessary for protecting Americans overseas. Do you think that there could be any long-term political repercussions here for the president?
Well, I think the real political message here is that Joe Biden is saying that he intends to be tough on Iran when necessary, even as his government, his Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, is moving forward with signaling that they want to restart talks around Iran's nuclear program. Of course, that was something that President Trump dropped the United States out of was the nuclear agreement with Iran. This White House is signaling it wants to move forward and figuring out a way to restart that agreement. But Biden is also saying, even though that is a priority for him, he is not going to sit back and not engage militarily and to show Iran he intends to be tough, no matter what the diplomatic side of the administration is doing. Mm.
Let's turn now to the first congressional hearings held this week on the January 6th insurrection and the security failings at the Capitol building. Yesterday, we learned from Acting Chief of Capitol Police Yogananda Pittman that extremists are still targeting the building.
We know that members of the militia groups that were present on January 6th have stated their desires that they want to blow up the Capitol and kill as many members as possible. With a direct nexus to the State of the Union, which we know that date has not been identified.
Scott, what struck you in the testimony that you heard this week?
Well, exactly that, that there is still an ongoing threat, according to the acting police chief of the Capitol, that there is a specific target, which is when Joe Biden will address a joint session of Congress. It's not the State of the Union, but it's his first major address to Congress. We don't yet have a date, so these are this is a general threat, but it's that specific event of the president coming to Capitol Hill. And what you're seeing is just an enormous amount of distrust, even 7 weeks after the January 6th attack, among Democrats and Republicans. In the wake of these riots, it's really permeating every facet of Capitol Hill, just everyday business. There's, verbal fights breaking out in committee meetings, in hallways, just an extreme amount of partisanship in the wake of these attacks. And there's reminders of January 6th everywhere you look. I mean, yeah. There's still 7-foot fencing around the entire Capitol complex and hundreds of National Guardsmen positioned at every corner of the Capitol.
Well, 2 weeks ago, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell pinned the blame for the January 6th riots squarely on President Trump. Here he is.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day.
But last night, Fox News host Bret Baier asked McConnell this question regarding Trump and a potential run in 2024.
If the president was the party's nominee, would you support him?
The nominee of the party? Absolutely.
A little bit of whiplash there, Beth. What is this signal to Republican voters?
Boy, it is whiplash, isn't it? I mean, I think one has to just look at the events taking place today at CPAC, the conservative gathering that happens every year for Republicans, and more recently, something that's turned primarily into an adulation of President Trump personally. It's no longer even suggested that it's anything other than that. So that's where Mitch McConnell realizes the energy the party still is. They're down there in Orlando now. Talking about holding panels on President Trump's claim that the election was stolen from him and that was rigged, all completely debunked and debased, but of course was the fuel that lit the fire that sent those rioters into the Capitol. So Mitch McConnell is walking a very delicate dance. He does not have a whole lot of Republicans with him in willing to condemn the president for provoking the riot. He has been sort of shamed by many in conservative media. And so he's taking the safe route. out and simply saying he will support the nominee of the party in 2024, probably personally hoping that it is not Trump, but he is simply saying that he will support whoever's the Republican candidate.
Scott, we have a minute here. I need you to weigh in on this, too. I don't understand. I still do not understand how McConnell can say Trump is morally responsible for the insurrection and then say he'd support him if he were the nominee. What do you think?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the entire party is still wrestling with this. And McConnell knows that, you know, they still need Trump voters to turn out at the elections. And in 2022, Trump is a major draw. He's still enormously popular. And so they need Trump voters to turn out and help them push them over the top in their quest to win back the Senate and the House.
Wow, politics. All right, indeed. Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, and Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News and MSNBC. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Violence against Asian Americans continues to rise across the country. A group tracking anti-Asian discrimination says there's been over 2,800 attacks since the pandemic began last March. Nearly half have been in California, where recent violence against seniors in Oakland's Chinatown has created fear and tension. And that's why a group called Compassion in Oakland has recruited a team of volunteers to accompany seniors as they walk through the neighborhood. Jess O'Young is one of the founders, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. And you are a Bay Area native, a fourth-generation Chinese-American. So what did you first think when you started to see these attacks in Oakland's Chinatown?
It's devastating. I mean, to say the least, it's really tough to see. You know, you see someone that looks just like your grandma, who you see as someone that you highly respect and has given up so much of their life, sacrificing, traveling all the way across the world, not knowing anyone, not knowing the language, and then having to fear for their lives when they are in retirement and deserve to really rest and relax and feel safe.
I know this group that you've become a part of was started when Jacob Acevedo's post asking for volunteers to help out went viral. That was after a 91-year-old Asian senior was shoved to the ground in Oakland. What made you decide to do something, though?
It was really tough because as an Asian American and growing up, my culture, or at least in my family, we didn't encourage, you know, speaking up and speaking out and taking action. But I felt so strongly that somebody had to do something and that this opportunity with Jacob was just the kind of push that I needed. Like, someone else is doing something, I can also do something. I have a voice. I live here. And that's what I was encouraged to do for myself.
A lot of people felt just like you. You've had over 600 people apply of all races and backgrounds to help volunteer. So let's get into that a little bit. How does it work? And what are those volunteers doing now?
Actually, we just checked this morning and we have over 700. So
wow,
it's amazing.
Great.
Yeah, it's really great. So what happens is we have a form online that people will fill out and then they'll get assignment to whatever their availability is to come to Chinatown and walk around. They will walk in pods and we usually make sure that one person in the pod actually at least speaks Chinese, so either Cantonese or Mandarin, and they'll walk around. They will talk to different businesses and people on the street, just talking about what we do and how seniors could call us and request for an escort or a chaperone, and we would be happy to help them.
It must make the seniors happy or feel good.
Yeah, we've been able to talk to a lot of the seniors on the streets, and one of the seniors was telling us that she's a vendor on the street corner, and she's in a really vulnerable spot because the corner is kind of a good place to just kind of grab and dash, right? So she said she's been robbed multiple times, and when the police are called, you know, it's kind of a minor crime, so they tell her to fill out the form and report online. You know, she can't operate a computer. Second of all, she can't really speak English very well or read English very well. So everything's in English, and it causes an obstacle for her to report her crimes. So we also will help, you know, seniors if they need something translated or to fill out a report. We're learning also what the needs are from these seniors.
You know, these attacks across the country against Asian Americans are being pinned, of course, to the emergence of the pandemic. also former President Trump calling COVID the Kung Flu. On the other hand, you know that anti-Asian racism is nothing new, unfortunately. So why is it important, do you think, that we talk about this, about what it means to be Asian in America right now?
This is a great crossroads for Asian Americans, that a lot of Asian Americans didn't have to think about what it means to be Asian in America. We kind of were just scooting by, to be honest, and we didn't have to be faced with those questions. And now that, you know, we're facing real blatant racism, that a lot of Asians are thinking about, what does that mean? What does that look like? And myself included, where, you know, when growing up, we didn't talk about what it meant. Like, that wasn't a family conversation that we would have around the dinner table, what that means to be Asian American. So I can imagine a lot of other Asian Americans are grappling with that question.
Jess O. Young, one of the founders of Compassion in Oakland. It's a group that's building community against the surge of anti-Asian hate crimes happening all across the country. Jess, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The short documentary film Colette is on the short list for an Academy Award. It tells the story of Colette Morin-Catherine, who, beginning at the age of 14, served in the French Resistance during World War II, along with her mother and older brother. Her brother, Jean-Pierre, was captured by the Gestapo and sent to a German labor camp, where he died. Colette vowed never to go to Germany. But then, in 2019, at the age of 90, she agreed to make a journey to the camp where her brother was murdered. She was accompanied by a young 17-year-old historian, Lucie Fubul, who was doing research on Jean-Pierre. I recently spoke with Colette through an interpreter, and I asked her why she and her family took the risk of serving in the resistance.
It's very simple. My mother came from Lorraine, and she was 14. During the First World War I, she lost her father and her two brothers. And she was really anti-Germany, and the whole family was not keen at all for the Nazis settling into France.
And you were very young when you served in the French resistance against the Nazis. Tell me about that experience. What did you do?
I was writing down the number on the plates and the number of German trucks that were passing by so that we would know how many trucks would be on the front lines.
Mm-hmm. And it's been so many years. What do you remember about your relationship with your brother?
My brother was 3 years older than me, and he was also very much in advance for his age. So I had a lot of admiration for him.
Well, after he was captured by the Nazis, they brought him to a death camp near Nordhausen, Germany, where he was unfortunately murdered. And in the years since, I understand that you've refused to step foot into Germany until just recently. Why did you change your mind?
It was to pay tribute to the memory of my brother. And I was not alone. I was with Lucie. We were very protected and away from the eyes of the tourists.
When you finally crossed over the border into Germany and you were there for the first time, what did it feel like?
Suddenly, when I heard all around me that everybody was speaking German, I felt as if I was back into 43, 42, 43, 44. I was suddenly put back into the time when France was occupied. But I must say as well, I want to make a big difference between the Nazis and Germany. I know it's two different countries.
Hmm. Soon afterwards, you and Lucy are walking through areas of the concentration camp where your brother was forced to work and where he died and where he was cremated. Did you feel as though that experience gave you some closure to go to those places?
Not a closure at all. On the contrary, it has reopened the wound.
Hmm. Well, that's what I want to understand, actually. I speak to you as a person who is more than 50 years younger than you, and it struck me in the film in that time when you were going through that difficult experience, I could feel the emotion and the pain inside you coming back. And it struck me that you've been hanging on to that pain for so many decades in your life, and the sorrows you've been carrying with you for so long were still so fresh.
Nobody can come out intact from such a journey. Those people who are saying that they've been into a concentration camp and they can talk about it with a light tone, these people, I can't understand them, because nobody can go to a concentration camp, see the site, and came out intact.
Well, time is passing so fast, and you and others will not be around forever to tell your stories. So what do you want the world to know and to remember about what happened to you and your brother and millions of others during the war?
To the young generation of all the world, I want to tell them courage, because we can see that now there's more and more inequalities, discrepancies between people. So you will need to find courage to fight against this. And we could see in World War II was the absolute horror. And I would like to tell them, never again, never again. Please, never again something like this. Have the courage to fight against inequalities.
Colette Marine Catherine, the star of the documentary, Colette, thank you so much.
So Peter, Colette is inviting you to take the tea at her place in Normandy whenever you come over.
I would love that. That would be amazing.
And she wants to tell you that she sends her love.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
And that was the producer of the film, Alice Druyar, who provided our interpretation. Colette is on the Oscars shortlist for Best Documentary Short Subject. The nominations will be announced on March 15th. We'll link you to the film at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at zooty.com.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it, and then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email?
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
President Biden is visiting Texas today to survey the damage from last week's deadly winter storm. More than a million Texans are still dealing with disruptions to their water service, and that includes 70-year-old Francois Wilson in Kerrville, Texas, an hour northwest of San Antonio. Francois, welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Our pleasure. And you know, it's been nearly 2 weeks since this disaster started. How are you holding up?
It's not been easy. I'm still without water. And that's the specter that hangs over my very existence now.
Well, how much damage is there to your house?
We won't know if there's broken pipes in, throughout, under the house until the water is running. So I don't know.
So give me a sense of what you do know. I mean, when you walk in and try to turn on the faucet, what happens? Nothing?
Oh, nothing. There is no water running. So turning on the faucet is futile, because I've known for well over a week now that there's no point in turning on the faucet. It's not going to happen.
Oh, we spoke to a plumber earlier this week in Austin who told us that there's a shortage of pipes, PVC pipes, and that's making it much harder to do repairs on homes. I assume that applies to you as well.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. And if you have other connections, like I have a water storage tank attached to the pump, because I am on well, as many in this rural area are, the water froze, and 25,000 gallons of water froze.
Wow.
And there was a booster pump that was supposed to operate to keep that water going and pumping into the house, and it basically burned out. Now, you cannot find a booster pump in the state of Texas. Although my plumber did snag one yesterday fresh off the truck.
Mm. So in the meantime, how are you getting by? You wrote us a letter a few days ago that said you'd gone a week without a shower.
Right. Yeah, that was fun. I did head to San Antonio to family when I knew we would be out of power during the duration of the bad weather and the extreme cold and all. And I did get to shower there. But once I got home, it was out of the question. So a friend who lives about 2 miles away, offered to let me shower at his home, which is what I took advantage of.
Sounds like you're kind of having to rely on getting help from your friends and from your neighbors at this point.
Yes, I do. I go to the same friend's house to get tap water so that I can wash my face and brush my teeth. But I use collected rainwater for the toilet. And I already, you know, you go to the store and you buy drinking water.
Yeah. You doing okay on food?
Surprisingly enough, yes.
Yeah, that's good. So meanwhile, that's happening. You're also trying to make sure that you stay safe from COVID. I know that. But you haven't been vaccinated yet. How worried are you about, I don't know, getting sick through all this?
Yeah, well, actually, the other day while I was speaking to the insurance agents, a COVID representative from the nearby community called me up and said that they could set me up for a vaccination. So I can check that off the list of worries.
Congratulations. That's great to hear. So you've got the President of the United States coming to Texas today. What do you want him to know about what you and other people are going through right now?
I would like him to know that people such as I are going to be relying on FEMA to recuperate some of the costs, because this is going to be hugely expensive. I also want him to know that even at this date, 2 weeks after the ice storm, I have neighbors up the road about 20 miles in the next town that are still without power.
Francois Wilson from Kerrville, Texas, about an hour northwest of San Antonio. You sound like a tough lady. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
It's been almost a year since the pandemic forced many children to stay home and learn virtually. Some are now back in class in person, some are enrolled in hybrid school, and others are still doing distance learning. Parents are juggling a lot with their children's education, and a new weekly column from The Atlantic aims to help them with some advice. It's called Homeroom, and Abby Freireich is a co-author. As a teacher, tutor, and parent, she describes herself in the center of the Venn diagram of education during the pandemic. And she joins us now from New York City. Abby, welcome. How nice to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You're one of the founders of the group Teachers Who Tutor in New York City. You're an educator, you're also a parent, and you've been helping a lot of other parents navigate distance learning. This column in The Atlantic with Brian Platzer has been appearing for about a month now. What have been the responses so far?
So we are hearing from parents from all over the country who, as you said, a year in are sort of at their wits' end. And they're also really responding to the sense of isolation that they and their children are feeling and unsure how to navigate these uncharted territories. And in addition, we're really hearing about how parents are feeling the attrition of having been at this for a year, many of whom are working parents trying to juggle the dual roles of being a parent and being a teacher. So parents are really exhausted and quite anxious. So the column has resonated with them and struck a chord in terms of trying to address some of their questions and concerns.
Sure has. It's resonated with me, I have to say. Is there a theme? Is that the theme, sort of the exasperation and the exhaustion of going through all this day after day after day?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it is really just the sense both of helplessness of parents and of complete and utter exhaustion, you know, and I can certainly relate. I have two young boys and they've been remote schooling for the past year. And there's a lot of, you know, you sit down to take a work call or write an email. And then there's mommy. I can't find such and such mom. Yes. Can you print this out for me, mom? So it's impossible to actually follow through with anything. And I think parents feel that they're failing on the work front and they feel that they're failing their children as parents and teachers, and trying to fill all of these roles simultaneously is beyond challenging. Mm.
Give us an example, Abby, of a letter or two and the response that you're giving from the parents in your column.
So one of the questions we got was particularly about screen time and how to sort of compartmentalize or draw boundaries when kids just want more and more time on the screen. And they want to be playing games with their friends because that's how they can hang out and connect with them. But they've been Zooming for, you know, 6 hours, and then to spend more time sitting, you know, sedentary in front of an iPad is really profoundly upsetting for a lot of parents to see. And we just want to get our kids away from this device and into the actual three-dimensional world. And what we really recommend is setting boundaries in advance. And I think that that's something that's helpful both for navigating the workday as parents while trying to help kids and for navigating screen time. So trying to sit down with kids in advance and have an honest conversation about, hey, last year, you know, you were on your iPad perhaps when you were on a trip or here and there, but now, you know, even if you look at screen time with kids, they can be quite surprised to see that, oh, you've spent 7 hours in the previous day sitting in front of the screen.
Yes.
And so to say, you know what, it's okay if you talk to your friends, but you need to take a break first, or you need to walk around the block, and also to really use screen time and to set limits so that kids know in advance, you know what, I have a half an hour after I've done my homework that I can be online. But, you know, that's it. Otherwise, it gets into the, can I please have 10 more minutes? My friend is on and it's so unfair. And so prior to any of that negotiation or haggling, just to sort of establish clear boundaries, I think can be really helpful for kids and for parents too.
I've got a couple of teenagers. You've got a couple of little kids. Beyond the screen time issue, which everyone is struggling with, what are you hearing in the range of struggles with kids in different ages and stages of education?
So all parents are worried that their kids are falling behind.
Yes.
That with distance learning, they are not where they would be had they been in the classroom for the previous year, which is absolutely the case. We're hearing a lot about how kids are sort of zoned out from Zooming all day, and they're feeling detached and disengaged, and parents are having trouble motivating their kids. And especially, you know, I think different ages are feeling the complexity and challenges of this moment in different ways. You know, the younger kids are much more kinetic and want to move around, and so it can be really challenging for them to be sitting for a long period of time. And with teenagers, they're feeling the isolation in a totally different way, where they're such formative years in terms of their adolescence and engaging with others. And we think all teachers right now feel that they are in the dual role, both of being academic supports to the kids and teaching them, and also that they are in part therapists, because this is all uncharted territory, for all children. In trying to figure out how best to navigate the challenges of this moment. And I think so much of it is just about, as teachers and parents, trying to be empathetic and not holding our kids to the standards that we did before, because they're trying to muddle their way through this as best they can, just as we are as parents.
Abby Freireich is co-author with Brian Platzer of the new advice column from The Atlantic called Homeroom. They also have a new book coming out on Tuesday. It's called Taking the Stress Out of Homework. Abby, thanks for your work and for helping give voice to many parents across the country right now. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
An update now on a story we brought you last fall. Advocates for people with hearing loss have convinced Zoom to provide closed captioning services for free. In November, advocate Sherry Eberts told us how people with hearing loss were struggling to use the video conference platform because the captioning service was behind a paywall. Well, this week, Zoom announced it was changing that policy. And Sherry Eberts is back with us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. And I know this must be big news for you and for the people that you know with hearing loss. So tell me what's happened since we last spoke.
Well, as you know, video conferencing calls are a great way to stay connected during the pandemic, and they're really tough for people with hearing loss. But captions can make all the difference, and we've been advocating for that. And on Wednesday, Zoom announced that they're going to move their high-quality automatic speech recognition captioning out from behind the paywall. And people with hearing loss are just thrilled about this. First, because we'll get the access that we need finally in terms of having the captioning for these calls. And also, it just shows the power of grassroots advocacy. And it's just such an empowering feeling for people with hearing loss to have their voice finally be heard.
Yeah. And for those who are hearing this story for the first time, it all started, you know, pretty soon after the pandemic broke out. You wrote an open letter to Zoom in April explaining how tough it was, as you say, for people with hearing loss to use the service without captioning. That turned into a petition. So when you had these conversations with Zoom most recently, what did you hear from them? And why do you think it took them so long for them to change their mind?
Yeah, I think that Zoom was feeling very overwhelmed by the pandemic. They had people using their platform in droves, and I guess they were not ready for that in terms of the technology. And so their priority was to roll out this feature to businesses who are paying for the plan. But I think that the petition really helped, as well as the media coverage of this issue, really helped bring this to the attention of Zoom's management. And I think they really started to understand how important the captions are for people with hearing loss. I'm just so grateful that they decided to move this out from behind the paywall.
You still will be waiting for a while because the captioning, I understand, isn't going to be up and running until the fall. And potentially by then, you know, the worst of the pandemic might be over. Is that okay with you?
Well, we asked Zoom's management to create an interim process because the fall, as you said, is very far away. And they agreed to do that. So for people with hearing loss and other people who need the captioning for accessibility reasons, they've created a process where you can request to have access immediately. There's a Google form that you need to go online and fill out, and that way you don't have to wait until the fall to have access.
Sherry Eberts, hearing health advocate and founder of the online community Living with Hearing Loss, just successfully pressured Zoom to make its closed captioning service free to its users. Sherry, congratulations and thank you.
Thank you.
Vermont is home to about 100 historic covered bridges, which attract tourists from all around the world. But earlier this month, the covered bridge in the small town of Troy burned down. As Vermont Public Radio's Anna Van Dyne reports, some residents there are mourning the loss of far more than history.
It was just before noon on Saturday, February 6th, and Heather Leidy was sitting on the couch with her husband. He showed her a video someone had posted online.
And it just said, bridge on Bayview Road. I just instantly started crying. And I called my mom. And I'm like, Mom, our bridge. She goes, what about our bridge? I'm like, it's burning.
And it was. The only covered bridge remaining in the Northeast Kingdom town of Troy, it stretched 92 feet across the Missisquoi River and 111 years of time itself. It was built in 1910 by the rough hands and old-time ingenuity of local farmers whose names don't show up in history books. Draft horses likely dragged the timber to the riverbank, and the bridge builders carefully assembled the wood into a style known as town lattice truss.
In the inside, you can see like all this like crisscrossing of the wood, and it made like noises underneath your feet when you walked on it, and you could do the echo, like you could holler, you could hear the echo.
Heather Leidy says that if you said hello, the bridge would say hello back. Walking through, she'd look at the names and messages etched into the wood.
It was just like going through history.
Then that Saturday, a snowmobile stalled halfway through the bridge and caught fire. According to a police report, the operator did what he could to stop the blaze with handfuls of snow. But old, dry wood burns easily. Troy Fire Chief Bobby Jacobs watched the bridge collapse into the river.
I didn't ever think that I would ever come across this or have to deal with it or see it.
This was not an entirely remarkable event. Bridges burn. Accidents happen. About 50 years ago, according to the Troy Town Clerk, a dump truck fell through the floor of this same bridge and killed the driver. This time, the whole bridge collapsed, but the snowmobiler made it out. It was something of a miracle that the bridge was there in the first place. Nathan Cody is a third-generation bridge restorer in nearby Morrisville. He worked on the bridge in 2008, and he says that when an engineer assessed the structure, they found that it shouldn't have been able to stand at all.
And he goes, nothing about this bridge works in calculations. He goes, this thing should fall down. But it's been here 100 years already, so we can't argue with that.
And no one did. The bridge was one of about 100 historic covered bridges left in Vermont and has been listed on the National Register of Historic Places since 1974. People came from all around to see it. It was both an attraction and a way to get from here to there. Fire Chief Bobby Jacobs also serves as Troy's road commissioner.
It was more of a convenience thing for people, kind of a shortcut, if you will.
Yes, I used to go over it often, and well, we used to see to it, of course. And I was taking care of the roads and stuff.
At 88, Howard Coda has been in Troy almost as long as the bridge has. He used to be the town's road commissioner. He hasn't been down to see the wreckage. He can't drive anymore, and even if he could, he wouldn't be going anywhere. He has cancer and has been staying at home with his wife Melba during the pandemic. But he does have his own small version of the bridge at home. He built it on the edge of his pond in his free time nearly 50 years ago.
I liked the bridge down there, and of course I used to take care of it and go across it and stuff there. So I built me one here.
Coda has 7 children, 14 grandchildren, and more than 20 great-grandchildren, including his granddaughter, Heather Lighty. Lighty played on the replica bridge as a kid, but most of her memories are tied to the one that burned down. Skipping stones, fishing, swimming, finding hidden treasures. As a 5th grader, she won a prize for a painting she'd done of it. As a teenager, it was a place to escape to.
I can't even explain it. It almost felt like you're in a whole nother world. That everything was going to be all right, and you could just relax. And there was always, like, someone laughing. You would never feel alone there.
A few days after the fire, the more intact side of the bridge looked as if it was trying to heave itself out of the icy water of the Missisquoi River. Bobby Jacobs, the fire chief, met me there.
Well, on this side, it still looks like it still has the shape of a bridge, other than being charred timbers. But the bridge is facing downward into the river. It's a complete mess. It's just devastating, really.
Troy's covered bridge traversed what was otherwise impassable. A river, a century, the space between two people. Now that it's gone, the town will likely construct some kind of replacement. But for the time being, Howard Cota's replica is the only covered bridge left in town. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Van Dyne, reporting from Troy, Vermont.
What a way to end the week. Great to be with you this week, Peter. Have a good weekend.
Yeah. Jane, it's been great to be with you, too. It's been a pleasure. It's a weekend you can relax now a little bit.
You too. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.